Blog Talk Radio.
Shalom, this is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. And we invite you to share comments and ideas with us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com or on our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging Radio, which is now up on Facebook. We are very honored and privileged today to welcome our first two guests, Dr. Edmund Weiss, a retired professor of communications and a prolific writer, and Carl Vinier, a former practicing lawyer, now professor of law at Rutgers here in southern New Jersey, and a mediator. Edmund, Carl, welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Nice to see you guys.
Nice to be here.
So, the theme of today really is going to be talking about people of our generation who are choosing to explore different paths, professional paths, personal paths. And for the two of you, you've decided in the recent years to enroll in rabbinic seminaries. So, Edmund, where are you studying?
I'm studying at an online institution called the Rabbinical Seminary International.
And that's located in
Elmsford, New York.
Oh, okay. And Carl, you are enrolled where?
At Aleph, the Organization for Jewish Renewal, and I'm enrolled in a rabbinic pastor program.
Rabbinic pastor. So basically, so you're in renewal here in Greater Philadelphia, and Edmund, you're online.
Non-denominational.
Non-denominational. Yeah. And the renewal is non-denominational, basically.
Correct.
Really, I mean, there's a renewal movement.
It's a movement. It's right. Not a denomination. And most of my classes are online also.
But really?
We have residential programs, but the
I got to ask you, as somebody who sat in class for 5 years at the Hebrew Union College with most of my friends, what's it like to study Talmud, for example, online?
Well, I don't study Talmud online. The position I take is that if the seminary wants me to learn something, I find a course or I find a teacher, and we do it together. I mean, the subject that lends itself least well to private study is Talmud, as you know.
Yeah.
It's all about debate and interaction. So
the Hevruta,
I find a teacher, and fortunately, we live in the Greater Philadelphia area, and there are endless resources, as well as all kinds of videos and things on the internet as well. Some things I can do on my own, but Talmud, for example, I need to have a good teacher.
So in your curriculum, and again, the name of the seminary is what?
Rabbinical Seminary International.
Rabbinical Seminary International. Mm-hmm. What are you taking? This semester, it's almost the end of this month. What did you take this semester?
We don't organize ourselves into semesters. This is a performance-based curriculum. The founder called it ordination by demonstration.
Explain that to them.
You prove to them that you have the chops. They give you a long list of topics. Mm-hmm. You choose from among those topics and you deliver approximately 35 major studies. I've written over 60,000 words since January of this year on a wide variety of topics. Right now, I'm reviewing Jim Kugel's book and a number of other books, which introduce you to the technique of biblical exegesis.
It's a good book.
And I stole the title of my paper. I'm going to call it Jews for Exegesis.
Just spell it right.
Yeah. But I, for example, am more interested in the Talmud than the Beit Din at my seminary is.
Mm-hmm.
The Beit Din is a group of rabbis that read my submissions and evaluate them. I'm more interested in Talmud than they are. So I've studied, for example, with Rabbi Sharfman in the Cherry Hill area and a number of other places.
Cool. And Carl, because I know you're in a – first of all, what's this rabbinic pastoral program? It's different from straight smicha?
Yes. Well, it is an ordination program.
Okay.
But it's an ordination as a rabbinic pastor. And it is aimed more at chaplaincy work. It's aimed more at pastoral counseling, but also life cycle events and things like that. And it's not intended to create a pulpit rabbi. It's not intended to create a rabbi who's going to sit on a Beit Din, because we're not rabbis. We're rabbinic pastors.
But you're getting ordination.
Yes, ordained as a rabbinic pastor. It's part of the the sense, as many rabbis have talked about the changing role of the rabbinate,
mm-hmm.
and this acknowledges it, that there are things that people need from rabbis that are very different from the traditional ordinated rabbi. And our program, by the way, is much more traditional in that it is done course by course, semester by semester, and right. we take our courses online.
So what are you taking this semester?
This semester, I'm taking a course on foundations in halakha, which is a very basic introductory course. We dealt with Tamur and Tahay and Tamur. We dealt with Shabbat. We dealt with Kashrut, just the basics. And I'm taking a course on the introduction of mysticism. That is a course where we're reading things about the Zohar and learning mm-hmm. from someone who is an expert, a Kabbalah expert.
So for the two of you, how long, given this is it sounds like somewhat of an individual approach, how many years either do they tell you or do you anticipate until you receive smicha or whatever they're calling it?
Yeah, my program ends with a smicha, and they call my degree the modern rabbi. unlike Carl, who works hard every day, I have nothing to do essentially.
Hardly.
And as a result, I'm able to do this work much more quickly than other students enrolled mm-hmm. in the program.
Are there mostly second career people?
That's its prime market. In fact, a high proportion of our students are cantors.
Really?
Who want to extend their range of opportunities within the Jewish community. One of the effects of the shrinking of congregational sizes is that some congregations want to have a cantor who can also serve in the rabbi's role.
Yeah, that's. I know several congregations who are doing that.
So, for example, one of the members of our Bet Din is currently the rabbi and cantor mm-hmm. at the Actor's Studio in New York City.
It's a nice gig.
It's a wonderful gig, and that's where my ordination survey will take place. So I write well. I'm already an academic by training.
Correct.
I have
you
a PhD.
Write well.
So I'm able to do it about 2.5 years, what most people would require 3.5 to 4 years.
So you're looking, how long have you been involved in the seminary?
I'm involved about 1.5 years now.
And you're looking at how many more years?
I intend to finish by June.
Of 18.
18, yes.
Cool. And Carl?
Well, I got a much longer road.
Well, you're working full time.
Because I'm not working full time, but I'm working.
Yeah.
And so I'm at this point only taking 2 classes a semester, mm-hmm. plus the classes that we take at our residential weeks, where we have several of them during the year. But it's at your own pace. If I was taking 4 or 5 classes a semester mm-hmm. and going full time, I might have been able to finish in 3 or 4 years. When I first started, my goal was to finish before I turned 70. I'm 66 now. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to make that.
Sure.
I'm not sure because I just don't have the time to take the full level of classes that I'd like to take.
Like in Edmund's program, are there most or many of the people in your cohort second career students?
Many of them are. There are some students who are younger and doing this as a full-time basis. There are people who have left jobs that they didn't like and are finally moving back to this and doing it full-time, but mostly people are working and doing it part-time.
So the obvious question that I got to ask you are 2 questions. One, why in God's name would you want to do this?
Well, then you answered the question with the question, right?
Yeah. No. Weiss, we can go around and round and round about. We've done that before.
Okay.
But why? Yeah. And B, once you're ordained, what do you want to do with it? So toss up question.
And, for me, the why is an interesting question because it is the completion of a really long journey. When I moved to the Philadelphia area in 1973 to work for Hillel, my intention was to go to rabbinical school. I actually wanted to go to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical School. I had friends there. I was very involved in Jewish communal service. I worked for Hillel, and I wanted to become a rabbi then, except I went to law school as part of the program that required a non-religious degree. I got out of law school. I got married. I thought I'd have a family. So my intention got a little displaced by the real world. And I ended up practicing law and then going into mediation. And now here I am, find out about this program that's not a bricks and mortar program that requires me to show up, that I can do part-time, that has the spirit that I really thought was missing, and I jumped at it. And this is where I want to go. Now, what do I want to do with it afterwards?
Yeah.
It's very interesting. I've spent 44 years helping people get divorced as a litigator and a mediator. I would love to help some people stay married and do some pastoral counseling. I'd even like to marry a couple here or there so that I actually am involved in the creation of something rather than the dissolution of something. And that's really my goal, is to be able to help people at that level. And to do pastoral counseling and education.
Where would you do it? At a congregation? Open up your own shop? I'm serious.
Yeah, I'm open to doing it anyway. I can't imagine having a job at a congregation that's a full-time.
Mm-hmm.
I was never interested in that when I wanted to be a rabbi the first time.
Mm-hmm.
But I could see aligning with a couple of congregations that bring me in to do things, or with unaffiliated people that are just looking for help. And there you open up your own shop.
Yeah, well, since the majority of our members are not members, they're unaffiliated. We'll get back to that in a minute. Edmund, so you...
Well, I think, as I reflect on it now, that I was fighting against becoming a rabbi most of my adult life.
Since I've known you, yes.
Yeah, and it's because my theory is that the version of Judaism that you're taught in Hebrew school, I call it the Disney version.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to be an intellectual like Carl or like I was at the time, you find it beneath you. You don't develop the respect you would develop for your rabbis if they revealed the full range of their intelligence and imagination to you instead of only the children's version that they revealed to you. And it wasn't until later in my life that I began to read the works of Richard Elliot Freeman and Gunther Plaut and people like that, that I began to realize that, astonishing as it might seem, there were rabbis who were at least as smart as I was, you know, and had more insights. Then I experienced a terrible personal loss that you're aware of. I lost my son. I went into a very long, deep despair. And then one day, after several years, I woke up one day and I wasn't in despair anymore. Two things that happened right after that was that I started spending more of my time at Congregation Makor Shalom, where I've been a member for 40 years and where I stayed away for a long time because I was bitter. And then almost a little while after that, I became over this program, and for reasons I still don't entirely understand, it talked to me, it spoke to me. I'd reached a time in my life where the only thing that was going up in my life was my creatinine and my blood test. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And I wanted something going up, something moving forward that would energize me a bit, make me look forward to the future a little bit more instead of simply trying to get through the days. And this program has fulfilled that purpose for me. I am eager to get to my studies. And as I told Rabbi Schwartz and a number of others, when I'm studying Torah with a good teacher and some good students, I experience a pleasure that is unlike any other pleasure I've known. It's the Darkei Noam, you know, and I just can't get enough of it, quite frankly.
No, I know when I teach, I've told this to many groups. We have these conversations about worship. I said I get more out of the engagement, intellectual engagement of teaching a class than I do in any worship service.
And if I may interrupt, Carl and I have often discussed the fact that that for the intellectual, for the person in the Maimonides tradition as opposed to the person in the Besht tradition, mm-hmm. intellectual activity is highly spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what some of the esoteric Jewish teachers don't fully appreciate. The romance of the intelligence can make your scalp tingle, can make your heart beat fast. Mm-hmm. And I personally love that experience. We agree, Carl, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the other hand, I love the intellectual part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the part where my intellect can't take me.
That piece
that I can't define. That moment that I feel something, that my hair tingles, that may not be in exploring something for which there is an answer, but exploring stuff for which I can't get answers anymore.
Is that the spiritual moment?
That is the spiritual moment. That's the moment that something happens that hits you, that just lights you up.
Yeah.
And interestingly, this week, a lot of people saw that Kirk Douglas turned 101. And people have asked, how come he lasted that long? Did he live a nice, clean life? And clearly, he didn't do that. But when asked about it, he said that he lived a life with purpose, with intention, with something that he was aimed at and in relationship with people so that he kept things going. And all of that is part of the spirit for me that has me want to engage weekly in Torah study, because there's a community that discusses things that are current, that move them forward, that give them purpose.
Well, I mean, every piece of research, every piece of literature, every conversation, you know, and I get this all the time when I'm on the road visiting and working with congregations for Jewish Sacred Aging, is it all comes back to, at this stage of our lives, finding meaning, finding purpose, whatever you want to call it.
I call it going home.
Well, in many ways, it is the metaphor of the garden. And, you know, Heschel calls us that we're creatures in search of meaning in one of his books. The symbolism that I take out of the Garden of Eden mythology is that it is, or the wilderness metaphor of trying to get to that place, whether it's the promised land, the Garden of Eden, whatever metaphor you want to use, that purpose, the reason to get up in the morning, and everybody does have a story about that. Everybody does have your story, Edmund, your son, and where you were, Carl, in that moment. I think nothing is isolated. Nothing happens in a vacuum. All of this is, interrelated. So you guys, look, you're in seminaries. One can probably make the argument, if you were sitting at HEC or JTS or even maybe RRC, non-traditional seminary experiences. You have, by the benefit of your own life experience, of you not in the immediacy, but you can take a look back at where your Judaism and your own personal, Carl, you were raised, you told me, in what kind of family?
I was educated at a Shalom Aleichem Folkshul.
So,
it was a Yiddish,
wow,
socialist, Folkshul kind of education.
In the good old days.
It was completely non-ritualistic.
Oh, yeah.
Although we had a Shabbat, a Friday evening celebration every Friday night. And many of the students didn't even get bar mitzvah. I did. My bar mitzvah was when we talk about how we come to these things, my bar mitzvah was in an Orthodox synagogue. My mother sat upstairs. Hmm. I so wanted my mother sitting next to me. Hmm. I mean, I was 13 years old. I was petrified. Hmm. I was in an Orthodox synagogue, which didn't make me feel too good to start with. I wanted my mother there. And that's one of the things that has brought me to a type of Judaism where there is an egalitarian service, where women and men are counted the same.
Carl, I just remembered sitting next to my mother at my bar mitzvah, and we had a wonderful cantor. He had a Sim Shalom that would break your heart, and my mother would think of her mother who had died, and she would cry whenever he sang that, and you gave me that memory back. Thank you so much, Carl.
And you were raised conservative, right?
That's correct. West Oakland Jewish Community Center. Yeah.
So you're going to be ordained in a variety of different ways and be involved in some way, I'm sure, in the community at large. And yet, as we all know, we're in the midst of this great transition in the American Jewish community, creating what I'm convinced is a new American Judaism. In the 10 minutes we have left of this segment, I really want to pick your brain about what your perception on. Are we in normative synagogue land, and the world in which you have observed and now studied both academically but also experienced? Where do you see the community going? Where do you see the non-Orthodox community? Because that's the ballpark you guys are going to be playing in and have played in for most of your adult life. Edmund, you alluded to, are we too pediatric in our emphasis? Certainly, it's one of the messages of Jewish Sacred Aging about you can't ignore what is basically the majority American Jewish community right now.
I love my synagogue. Let me state that in no uncertain terms. I've been a member of Congregation Makor Shalom for 40 years this coming September. And I love my synagogue. And what I derive from my synagogue is not something you can derive from hiring a rabbi to conduct a service for you and then be gone after he's collected his fee. I do not disparage the fee-for-service rabbi, but my problem is, how can I communicate to people what a sacred community really is? It's one of those things, like with jazz, either you get it or you don't get it, you know? And I got it. I've lived most of my life with my synagogue wrapped around me,
mm-hmm.
to sustain me. At one point in my life, almost every close friend that I had, I acquired through my synagogue. So even though I'm going to be an independent rabbi, I am committed to the well-being of community synagogues. I don't want to break down that structure. And I also am committed to the high-quality work that's done by the Reconstructionist Seminary and the HUC, and I don't want to take away any work from the graduates of those institutions because the jobs are getting fewer as demand decreases. I wouldn't want to take away a day's work from any of those young people that have gone through those programs. So how will I fit in? I'm not sure. I have this image of myself working with a young boy or girl who, because of Asperger's or hyperactivity, takes too much time for the school to prepare for a bar bat mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
And I have an image of myself doing that without being compensated, even though I'm told you can get $80 or $100 an hour now for bar mitzvah preparation. I happen to know how to teach the chanting of the Torah. It's a coincidence that I know that. I can see myself doing that. I can see myself marrying a friend. But I've seen too many beautiful rabbinic wedding services to believe that I could actually carry off something that moving, that genuine, that beautiful. I will marry a friend if a friend wants to be married. Mm-hmm. I will marry a couple who are having trouble finding a clergyman to preside. But I don't want to take away the marriage business from people who really do it with the kavona that a wedding deserves, you know? So I don't know where I'm going to fit in. And I know I will continue to write. And it's even possible, if I may be just a little bit cynical, it's even possible that if I put rabbi in front of my name, there are some things I write that'll get paid attention to that might otherwise not get paid attention to.
Sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
The question about where the synagogue is going, where the movement is going.
Or the movements.
First of all, I think the movements are getting closer and closer together. Renewal filters into all of them. Different renewal rabbis work in different places. People who follow renewal don't just go to renewal congregations. They go to other ones. And we see these movements getting closer and closer together,
mm-hmm.
Not seeing a lot of difference between a conservative reform congregation and a liberal conservative congregation. You walk into the services, they look very similar. But the question you ask is, what happens to the community synagogue? And I love that word because I think that's what we're going to end up seeing. I still think there's need for a building, someplace for people to go to,
mm-hmm.
but I think it's going to have to provide a lot more varied things for people. So it may be multiple services. The renewal movement, one of its origins was the Chavurah movement, and we need to have that sense. When Edmund talks about having this community around him, that surrounds him, I think people need that to explore their spirituality, their sense of what it is that they're purposes for, to engage in activities, and the synagogue will always be able to provide that. It can't provide it by being singular in its emphasis and singular in the way they give people what I used to refer to as performance Judaism, where people would just come in and sit there and the rabbi and the cantor and sometimes the choir would perform. People need to be engaged, and you need to do that with a lot of different types of people. That's where I see it going.
What do you guys see the role of worship? I mean, community we agree on. But one of the things I see as I travel is less and less people are sitting in the pews on Friday night or Shabbos morning. I keep asking the question, because I asked this at actually McCore, what are you worshiping? What's the role of worship in this?
Rabbi Hirsch, who currently works at McCore Shalom, told a wonderful joke the other day. He said he knew somebody. He says, going to synagogue is boring. It's always the same thing. Kol Nidra, right? I don't know how to engage people. My wife is an expert in the management of volunteers. She at one time was the head of all the volunteer organizations at McCourt Shalom and a kind of coordinating role. And she says the key to the volunteer is not to think that once you have found something that a person likes to do, that the person will keep doing that thing contentedly forever. Once you find things that people want to do, you're not finished serving them. You have to create other things that they want to do. Otherwise, they go bored. They lose their enthusiasm. So there always have to be things to do. Our cantor created a klezmer orchestra for our synagogue and then put me in charge of it, even though I hardly knew what the word meant at the moment. And then she created a special ensemble for a kind of folk song-oriented religious service, and she put me in that ensemble. And and last Friday I played with that ensemble.
Is that worship, Edmund? Is that worship?
Well, for me, performing music is the most intense form of worship. I always thought that God should pay royalties to the composers of the songs, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But for me, my relationship with God is based on contemplation rather than worship.
It's interesting that you ask that question, because one of the concerns that I've always had is that there's a mismatch between the liturgy that we use for worship and what people believe.
A huge mismatch. It's a huge disconnect.
So when people are praying, you know, God our Father, and then say, I don't believe in God, it's hard to engage in that worship. But I actually think there needs to be a conversation about God and what that means to people. Because when we try to worship with traditional liturgy, where many of us at this age group were raised with a God who sat on a throne and threw down punishment, it's hard to believe in that God. And most of the people that I deal with don't believe in that God.
You're going to be a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. You're going to get these people that you're talking to. They're going to come to you and ask the both of you, you know, I'm sure in your conversations in class, somewhere along the line, this basic elementary question has been raised.
Yeah. Reb, 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, I actually did I led a conversation at McCourt, the first chapter of Zalman Schachter Salomi's book, Jewish with Feeling. And the first chapter is God, oy, what a word. And the whole conversation is about how we have different needs in terms of God. And people do need sometimes to talk to someone outside of themselves that's not their therapist. And so there is this need that we have for reaching something that's bigger than we are, and we have to be able to figure out how to deal with that. Not necessarily how to have the answer, what is it, because there is no answer to that, but how do we deal with it is the question that we have to look at. And there is a relationship between people and something that is bigger than us, and I just have no problem anymore calling it God, mm-hmm. without having God be an anthropomorphic being somewhere separate. And that's what we look for is in worship, is how do we contact that? How do we relate to that? How do we deal with that moment where you have that aha moment that you just want to reach more often? And that to me is what we should be looking for with worship.
And Edmund, your response when you sit in that synagogue and look at those words, are you there, or is really your soul someplace in a different level of reality?
I must be out of step, because I am in the words.
Mm-hmm.
I like the taste of the Hebrew prayers in my mouth.
Rather than the English? Because that is a big difference.
Well, yeah, I don't read the English. And in fact, I think that the choral reading of the English merely underscores how deadly dull most of the English is. And but I like the feel of Hebrew in my mouth. It's not magical or mystical. It's simply pleasurable,
mm-hmm.
For me. But I view God as I like Mordecai Kaplan's definition that God is the imputed personality of the universe. God is reality. And if reality had a face and a personality, that would be the God that we're talking about. But I don't believe that God does anything. So for me, prayer never involves petitioning.
prayer involves then what?
Reflection. Reflection.
It's internal?
Contemplation and reflection, yes.
So we've been speaking on this segment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio with Dr. Edmund Weiss and Carl Vinier, both members of the generation, let's say with life experience, who have chosen in this stage of life to move into studies in rabbinic seminaries, two different types of approaches, but online in many cases. And in the 30 seconds we have left of this segment, standing in front of your people, perhaps sooner rather than later, what's one key piece of advice that you would give us right now?
Who's us?
All of us. The Jewish people, your congregation, the people at Makor, let's say, in your congregation. If you had to distill one piece of advice is saying this is really at the core of where I am and what I'm studying. What is it?
Everything is impermanent. Wisdom consists in understanding that and accepting it.
Yeah, I think that Judaism and being Jewish gives us a great way to look at the future, not the past. And that's where it is for me.
Edmund, Carl, thank you very much. I wish you much luck, good luck, and good luck in ordination. And let me know. We'll have a party. And
we'll put a picture on Facebook for you.
We will.
God bless Facebook. whatever. Just anyway, we're going to get started on that. And the role, by the way, of social media and electronics in all of our future rabbinates is something that really is the subject for
a whole
other show. But thank you very much for being with us. And I wish you good luck, and I'll see you soon, I hope. Say hello both to your families and be well. Take care. Have a good Hanukkah and a good secular, healthy 2018.
You too, Rabbi. In Yotzei Hashem. Thank you, Rabbi.
Cool.
Podcasting Passion into Profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Welcome back to our next segment here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio today. Today's program dealing with boomers who are making significant transitions and developing new things as part of their life. And I'd like to welcome to the microphone by phone Udi Bar-David. Udi, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, Richard.
Hi. How you doing? How are you?
Great. Good. Happy Hanukkah. Thanks. Good to talk to you.
Yes. Yes, thank you. You too, and to your whole family.
Thank you.
Udi is a cellist of great note and renown with the Philadelphia Orchestra. Some of you may have heard of that ensemble, but more importantly for our purposes today, Udi has been involved in the creation of something called Art Tolerance. And if I can read what you sent me, Art Tolerance's mission is to advance the role of the arts in dialogues, transcend communication boundaries, and explore common ground through performances, events, conferences, and workshops. Udi, translate that for me. What is art tolerance? Why did you start it? What does it do?
Well, it's art tolerance is really a continuation of, kind of natural continuation of 19 years of cross-cultural experiences that started in a visit to a place called Neve Shalom, Oasis of Peace, Wahat al-Salam, which is near Jerusalem, a place where Arabs and Jews live side by side, literally actually live together in the same village, and working all their internal affairs together, including alternating mayors. All the children are bilingual, they have a school for peace, etc. And that evolved over the next few years into the realization that as a musician and an artist, I do have an opportunity through collaborative efforts with other artists to really make more of an impact in dialogues, in engaging people in conflict resolution or conflict transformation, bringing people together, creating a safe environment, and ultimately, which is the mission of the translation of the mission of Art Tolerance, is for artists to be sitting together with decision makers, whether they are academics, religious leaders, political leaders, etc., sitting at negotiation tables and contributing a process, an artistic process that could be translated into real dialogue.
You use music as a key for this, right? And it's a multi-faith, multicultural, and I call it an ensemble or program.
Well,
does that work?
Well, I mean, the last event I did in Philadelphia at the Gershman Y last month was actually I put together an Iranian graphic designer, a modern dancer, a Puerto Rican drummer, and myself, whatever I am, a blend of worlds. And we actually also broke barriers between art forms, which in a sense is a symbolic to how we can break barriers between people in conflict. And maybe making a segue, if I may, to our own internal aspirations for future Jewish and Israeli unity, I do welcome that challenge of finding inclusive platforms that allow Israelis, whether in Israel or American Israelis or American Jews and American Jews, to be able to hear each other, even if it's not always in context of agreement, because I think it would strengthen us and it would help us find solutions and to these times when we are in transition. I was listening to your last few seconds of your previous guest when you spoke about transition, because we are certainly in transition, definitely not just in the Jewish world.
But Udi, did you just wake up one day and say, gee, I'd like to do this? What was that pivotal point that moved you to create Art Tolerance?
Well, I mean, there were a number of pivotal moments. As I mentioned, the first one was 19 years ago. I was also spending time practicing Zen Buddhism with a very prominent Buddhist monk, Thich Nhat Hanh, in Europe. So there was a kind of a cosmopolitan impact on me and a transition. I think the recent transition honestly happened a little bit during the elections, or during the campaigns, actually, because I realized how far apart and how conflict-ridden is our entire system. And simultaneously, I realized that, okay, Israel 70 celebrations are coming up, and I would like to be part of finding ways again to a unified platform. And I'll take it beyond what I just said a few minutes ago, that platform is not just to unify Jews and Israelis, but it's also to offer some ways that maybe introducing us a different future in the Middle East, a future that is based on new realities that take courage, take risks, certainly takes more than anything the openness to changing mindsets. And of course, it includes a very important dialogue with Arabs, with Palestinians. If I may, on Facebook this morning, I posted two very important, beautiful documents. One from the Arab American Museum, and another one is by a prominent Jewish professor from Jerusalem about the significance of the three religions, the meaning of Jerusalem to the three monotheistic religions. And it was so beautifully done, so accepting, so open, realization of the overlapping areas between the three monotheistic religions, that the transition is important. I already forgot what your question was, but sorry, I went on and on.
No, but you did. I mean, the last pivotal movement or point of pushing you to develop this was, you know, I guess I'm hearing you correctly, the challenges of division in the society, et cetera, not only here, but overseas as well as in Israel. You travel with Art Tolerance. It's not just local here in the Delaware Valley. You go around the world, correct? You've done stuff in other countries.
I have been blessed. So some of my journeys have been in context of Philadelphia Orchestra trips, whether it's Europe or Southeast Asia, including Vietnam. And then as an extension of that, I have been collaborating with many artists to represent different ethnic, religious, national groups, etc. Across the U.S., again in Europe. Most memorable probably 7 years ago when we were introducing a Middle Eastern ensemble with an Arab-Israeli performer, Jewish-Israeli, myself, and a Puerto Rican drummer, with a small chamber orchestra from Italy sponsored by the Vatican. And literally, our first performance event took place in a cathedral in Italy. The next night in Bethlehem on the West Bank, the next night in the Jerusalem Theater. So, and the way we were received by, especially for me, especially meaningful by Palestinian audiences who really congratulated me in Hebrew. In Hebrew, these are Palestinians in Bethlehem. That's, you're talking about pivotal moments. Yes, that gives you an understanding that in the arts, we do have the tools to make an impact. And sometimes people are skeptical, but I'm not, because I've seen, and we, with our tolerance, we're developing what I call dialogue in three movements, which is actually an artistic process that simultaneously we are going to engage religious and political leaders in simultaneous process on and off stage, whether public venues or in workshops, and essentially provide some specific processes that hopefully decision makers will borrow from. And we're doing programs in, for example, February. I'm doing a program at Penn, February 18th, with multiple faith organizations on campus. March 7th at Beth Zion, Beth Israel, Center City, near Rittenhouse Square, Philadelphia. That will be devoted, we're calling it One Song, and it would be an implementation of this dialogue in three movements, concentrating on diversity and inclusivity in Israeli society as we celebrate Israel's 70th birthday.
So if somebody's listening here and said, this is something that I would like to bring to my community, how do they contact Art Tolerance?
We are about to launch our website, hopefully within 10 days, which will be arttolerance.org. For this transition, we have our Facebook, Art Tolerance Facebook, and for a lack of better communication for the next few weeks, I offer my email address, which is ubdavid@mac.com. Again, it's ubdavid@mac.com. And there will certainly be ways to connect with us because we would love to bring these platforms to many Jewish communities in this country and really open up new avenues for dialogue and performances simultaneous.
So, Udi, the website that's going to emerge, and this program will be carried on as a podcast and archived on JewishSacredAging.com. So, you know, people may pick this up in January, February, March. And so Art Tolerance, is it A-R-T and then Tolerance, or is this just one T? So people
one
know
word.
How to spell
one
it.
One T, yes. Just one word, arttolerance.org. That should be the site, and expect it within a couple of weeks. Yes, but Facebook is active already, has been.
No, I know.
For quite some time.
I know the Facebook page of Our Tolerance, and you post regularly. And this dialogue in three movements, I think it's important for people to understand that this is not just music or art. It's a total sort of like holistic approach to dialogue. Am I correct on that? It's not only
because there are three steps in the individual introductions to getting to know you, which is actually the art of bridging and finding commonalities, to establishing a common language, which is the third step of it and the culminating part of it, and what I like to call fusion without confusion. So, yes, and then the simultaneous process is supposed to be what we will inspire others to do with us, again, on stage and off stage, and hopefully provide concrete solutions to concrete ideas to those who are responsible to very important and difficult dialogues.
So Uri Bar-David, who's really the mover and shaker behind this Art Tolerance program and this aspect of it, Dialogue in Three Movements, available to really try to break down barriers and bring understanding in a time when we need it more than anything else through the variety of arts. The website that's coming up, arttolerance.org, and you can go to Art Tolerance on Facebook and the Facebook page and be connected with what they're doing. Uri, thank you very much for
being
part of here of Jewish Sacred Aging, Chag Sameach. Just stay healthy in regards to your family, too. Thank you very much.
Same to you, Richard. Have a good Hanukkah.
Take care. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Welcome back to our final segment here on today's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. And we are very pleased to welcome to the microphone, actually a classmate of mine from the infamous class of 1972, which will leave for another story for another time, Rabbi Lee Lerner. Lee, welcome. Welcome to Jewish Sacred Aging. Are you in Italy or are you in Montreal?
No, I'm in Montreal.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Welcome. We're here to talk about your novel, The Mossad Messiah, recently published. Rabbi Lerner recently retired from his pulpit in Montreal, Canada, and sat down and wrote this novel, recently published by Counterflow Press. Is this available, I would imagine, on the great God Amazon, Lee?
Yes, it is, Richard. It's available on Amazon very easily. You can get the ebook on Amazon. You can get the paperback on Amazon. But if you want to go to any bookstore, we have people who bought them from Barnes & Noble, et cetera.
Okay.
You just have to order it.
So, Mossad Messiah, a novel subtitle, A Novel of Israel, has some eerie attachments to things that are happening in the world as we speak. And as I read through the book, I also couldn't help but flash on some Torah portions, and not the least of which was the Judah and Tamar thing from last Shabbat. I got to ask you, what was the motivation before we get into the plot? And we won't do a spoiler alert because for people who want to buy the book. But what was the motivation of you sitting down and writing this?
Well, the motivation for it, honestly, has been years and years of difficulty that Reform and Conservative Jews have had in getting the recognition and their place in the sun. We have now about 11% of the Israeli population saying, yes, we identify with Reform and Conservative Judaism, and yet we still have rabbis who can't do marriages, who can't do funerals. We have rabbis unsubsidized by the state, whereas the Orthodox have the state subsidizing them. And in particular, it has to do with what ultra-Orthodoxy has done and will be able to do even more in Israel if they continue to grow at a 5% annual rate. So I could name for you some of the issues that they present, but I first want to say, if I may, that I am not opposed to people being ultra-Orthodox if that's what they wish to do. I'm just opposed to bad policies that are detrimental to Israel and to the equality of all under the law.
Well, I'm looking at page 100 of the book where you write in a dialogue with some of the characters. This sentence, it says, the inordinate rise in population and influence of Haredi and Hasidic Jews acutely troubles Israeli security services, all of them, because the situation could put the state of Israel in jeopardy. And that when I read that in reading the book, it just jumped out of saying, well, maybe that's the thesis of or underlying thesis of this entire book of how to deal in an internal religio-political way with what you're talking about, this disconnect on various segments of society. And you weave this tale with great ingenuity and I think creativity with developing the Messiah. And so I got to, how did you come to that? Because and the person themselves and how they got to be that, that's what flashed on last week's Torah portion. But how did you approach this through, I think I'm going to write this through the possibility of actually delivering somebody who would be the Messiah. How did you arrive at that? It's pretty cool.
Well, it was a matter of how in the world can ultra-Orthodoxy be changed in certain ways. And I said to myself, well, I suppose if Israel will pass laws, that will do it. But so far, and we've been waiting a long time for this, 70 years, the laws really haven't changed very much at all. And every time we move a step forward, then Knesset seems to pull back. If I can, let me enumerate some of the issues. First of all, there's a population explosion in central Israel that people... Israel's a great success, and at this point, Israel has a population density in central Israel of 5,254 people per square mile, 2,000 per square kilometer. Tel Aviv, you know, you hear people talk about Gaza being the most, you know, one of the most populous places on earth per square mile. Tel Aviv is much more populous than Gaza. Tel Aviv is 8,000 people per square kilometer. And to give you an example, a typical Midwestern place, Twin Cities Metro in Minnesota, is 515 people per square mile. So there's a huge population explosion in the center, and that makes housing very expensive and difficult to navigate because of traffic jams, etc. Israel has a constitution that was never finished. It's called the Basic Laws. And the reason it was never finished was because of objections by the ultra-Orthodox to equal rights. And the essence of the argument is Israel a Jewish state or is it the state of the Jews? And so I'm kind of assuming that Mossad and Shin Bet have a lot of chutzpah and decide in the midst of this whole issue that it should be the state of the Jews. Because 89% of the ultra-Orthodox 89% want Israel to be governed by Jewish law, halakha, as determined by their rabbis. In addition, Israel exempted itself from the UN Declaration of Human Rights regarding marriage, regarding civil status. There's no room for civil marriage. That's a problem for LGBT people, for mamzerim, for anti-religious people in the hundreds of thousands in Israel. You can't get married in Israel unless you get married as a Jew by an Orthodox rabbi, and mostly the ultra-Orthodox have kept it that way. Army draft numbers are down because of the large number of yeshiva exemptions, 108,000 people in 2015. And I have to say that the court has ruled that, the Supreme Court of Israel has ruled that unfair, and they're going to start drafting, but they said that in the past, they passed laws in the past like that. And unfortunately, the laws were changed to get around other decisions and other laws. And it's a huge drain on government money because folks who go to yeshiva get a subsidy from the government. People who don't go to yeshiva but go to university, they don't get a subsidy from the government. And 56% of the ultra-Orthodox are living below the poverty line. So the welfare payments are huge. The Bank of Israel in 2013 declared that unless Israel does something about this mess, they're going to have a very unfair welfare system and the country will not be able to afford it. Finally, there was a status quo agreement in 1947 that David Ben-Gurion made, saying that Haredi and Hasidic schools could teach their curriculum, no problem, as long as they kept a curriculum that had to do with what the state needed from its educational point of view. But right now, many Haredi schools don't teach science, don't teach math, don't teach civics, don't teach English, and the proof of the pudding is 17% of Haredim only passed the high school final exam. Too much of the group is trained to be unemployable. So all of that needs to change. How do you do it? So I said to myself, well, in 70 years, Israel really hasn't done a lot to change the situation, and it's just grown more and more anxiety creating. So since all these groups are waiting for the Messiah, I'll send them a Messiah.
So you send them Nahum, whose genealogy itself is interesting. And so before we run out of time, Lee, because we're going to start backing up we only have about 2 or 3 minutes in this segment.
Okay.
Talk to me literally real fast about Nahum and his journey.
So
how do we get
this Messiah to come? It's very okay. Let's assume that Nahum is in love with and wants to marry the daughter of a very important Hasidic rabbi. And he himself is related to this rabbi. However, he'd rather be an engineer than a rabbi. So he goes to Berlin with the permission of his fiancée, which they made the deal very privately. Father doesn't know about this. And in Berlin, where he's studying, he has an affair. The woman becomes pregnant. She's a big Zionist and wants to go to Israel. He's waiting for the Messiah, and besides, he likes the life in Europe. So this is in 1928. So she goes to Israel without him and tells him, don't contact me, don't contact my offspring. He does support them secretly, this man, and he ultimately inherits the rabbi's court, marrying his daughter and becoming the Rebbe of this big group. And now he's 90-some years old, he's about to die, and his wife has had no children, and she passed on. What's he going to do to provide a leader in the as a new Rebbe? Mossad knows of money transfers to Israel to support the family, and they know that he has a great-grandson who's interested in Torah, but who's we would call him maybe secular, but he's a member of a Reform congregation in Tel Aviv, Beit Daniel. And they go to him and they make him an offer which could lead possibly to his becoming the new Rebbe and bringing his attitudes into this ultra-Orthodox group and ultimately perhaps making the changes. How he becomes the Messiah or whether he becomes the Messiah is part of
the
plot. So let's say read the book. But the folks who, the people who have been the Rebbe of this group have over the years always claimed to be a descendant of King David and possibly a candidate for Messiahship. And that's the story.
All right. So Rabbi Lee Lerner, the book is called The Mossad Messiah, a novel of Israel, available at your local bookstore or on Amazon. Very interesting approach.
Very easy to go to Mossad, M-O-S-S-A-D, Messiah.com and click on Shop USA or Shop Canada, and it goes right to Amazon. So it makes life easy.
Thanks a lot, Lee. Listen, good luck with this. Have a good holiday.
Thank you, Richard.
Take care. To all of you, I want to thank you for being a part of today's broadcast on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows, as we know, are podcasted on archive this podcast on JewishSacredAging.com. And again, like the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio on Facebook, you can contact us at rabbiaddress@jewishsacredaging.com. Thank you to our producer, because these shows are produced through the facilities of Lubetkin Global Media in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We look forward to seeing you again on the next week's edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. Take care. Shalom. Thank you for listening.